Chapter 17. So, already at that time, not already, he growled. But hold on, I interrupted. He Sagamore belonged to Mundy and Rogers, I've been told. He snorted contemptuously. Am boatmen know no better. Flew the firm's house flag. That's another thing. Favor. It was like this. When old man Dunbar died, Captain Harry was already in command with the firm. George chucked the bank he was clerking in, to go on his own with what there was to share after the old chap. George was a smart man. Started warehousing, then two or three things at a time. Wood pulp, preserved fruit trade, and so on. And Captain Harry let him have his share to work with. I am provided for in my ship, he says. But by and by Mundy and Rogers begin to sell out to foreigners. All their ships go into steam right away. Captain Harry gets very upset, lose command, part with the ship he was fond of, very wretched. Just then, so it happened, the brothers came in for some money and old woman died or something. Quite a tidy bit. Then young George says, there's enough between us two, to buy the Sagamore with. But you'll need more money for your business, cries Captain Harry, and the other laughs at him. My business is going on all right. Why, I can go out and make a handful of sovereigns, while you are trying to get your pipe to draw, old man. Mundy and Rogers very friendly about it. Certainly, Captain. And we will manage her for you, if you like, as if she were still our own. Why, with a connection like that, it was good investment to buy that ship. Good. I, at the time. The turning of his head slightly toward me at this point was like a sign of strong feeling in any other man. You'll mind that this was long before Cleet came into it at all, he muttered, warningly. Yes. I will mind, I said. He generally say. Some years passed. That's soon done. He eyed me for a while silently in an unseeing way, as if engrossed in the thought of the years so easily dealt with. His own years too, they were, the years before and the years, not so many, after Cleet came upon the scene. When he began to speak again, I discerned his intention to point out to me, in his obscure and graphic manner, the influence on George Dunbar of long association with Cleet's easy moral standards, unscrupulously persuasive gift of humor, funny fellow, and adventurously reckless disposition. He desired me anxiously to elaborate this view, and I assured him it was quite within my powers. He wished me also to understand that George's business had its ups and downs. The other brother was meantime sailing to and fro serenely, that he got into low water at times, which worried him rather, because he had married a young wife with expensive tastes. He was having a pretty anxious time of it generally. And just then Cleet ran up in the city somewhere against a man working a patent medicine, the fellow's old trade, with some success, but which, with capital to the tune of thousands, to be spent with both hands on advertising, could be turned into a great thing infinitely better paying than a gold mine. Cleet became excited at the possibilities of that sort of business, in which he was an expert. I understood that George's partner was all on fire from the contact with this unique opportunity. So he goes in every day into George's room about 11, and sings that tune till George gnashes his teeth with rage. Do shut up. What's the good? No money. Hardly any to go on with, let alone pouring thousands into advertising. Never dare propose to his brother Harry to sell the ship. Couldn't think of it. Worry him to death. It would be like the end of the world coming. And certainly not for a business of that kind. Do you think it would be a swindle? Asks Cleet, twitching his mouth. George owns up. No would be no better than a squeamish ass, if he thought that, after all these years in business. Cleet looks at him hard. Never thought of selling the ship. Expected the blamed old thing wouldn't fetch half her insured value by this time. Then George flies out at him. What's the meaning, then, of these silly jeers at ship owning for the last 3 weeks? Had enough of them, anyhow. Angry at having his mouth made to water. See? Cleet, don't get excited. Dot, I am no squeamish ass either, says he, very slowly. Tis selling your old Sagamore once. The blame thing wants tomahawking.
Seems the name Sagamore means an Indian chief or something.
The figurehead was a half-naked savage with a feather over one ear, and a hatchet in his belt. Tomahawking, says he. What do you mean? Asks George. Dot reckon it could be managed with perfect safety, goes on Cleet. Your brother would then put in his share of insurance money. Needn't tell him exactly what for. He thinks you're the smartest businessman that ever lived. Make his fortune too. Dot, George grips the desk with both hands in his rage. Dot, you think my brother's a man to cast away his ship on purpose? I wouldn't even dare think of such a thing in the same room with him, the finest fellow that ever lived. Dot, don't make such noise. They'll hear you outside, says Cleet. And he tells him that his brother is the salted pattern of all virtues, but all that's necessary is to induce him to stay ashore for a voyage, for a holiday, take a rest, why not? Dot, in fact, I have in view somebody up to that sort of game, Cleet whispers. George nearly chokes. Dot, so you think I am of that sort? You think me capable? What do you take me for? Dot, he almost loses his head, while Cleet keeps cool, only gets white about the gills. Dot, I take you for a man who will be most cursedly hard up before long. Dot, he goes to the door, and sends away the clerks. There were only two to take their lunch hour. Comes back. Dot, what are you indignant about? Do I want you to rob the widow and orphan? Why, man, Lloyd's a corporation. It hasn't got a body to starve. There's 40 or more of them perhaps who underwrote the lines on that silly ship of yours. Not one human being would go hungry or cold for it. They take every risk into consideration. Everything I tell you. Dot, that sort of talk. H'm. George, too upset to speak, only gurgles and waves his arms. So sudden, you see. The other, warming his back at the fire, goes on. Wood pulp business next door to a failure. Tin fruit trade nearly played out. Dot, you're frightened, he says. But the law is only meant to frighten fools away. Dot, and he shows how safe casting away that ship would be. Premiums paid for, so many, many years. No shadow of suspicion could arise. And, dash it all, a ship must meet her end someday. Dot, I am not frightened. I am indignant, says George Dunbar. Cleet boiling with rage inside. Chance of a lifetime is chance. And he says kindly, your wife'll be much more indignant when you ask her to get out of that pretty house of yours and piling into a two-pair back with kids perhaps too. Dot, George had no children. Married a couple of years. Looked forward to a kid or two very much. Feels more upset than ever. Talks about an honest man for father, and so on. Cleet grins. You be quick before they come, and they'll have a rich man for father, and no one the worse for it. That's the beauty of the thing. George nearly cries. I believe he did cry at odd times. This went on for weeks. He couldn't quarrel with Cleet. Couldn't pay off his few hundreds. And besides, he was used to have him about. Weak fellow, George. Cleet generous too. Don't think of my little pile, says he. Of course it's gone when we have to shut up. But I don't care, he says. Dot, and then there was George's new wife. When Cleet dines there, the beggar puts on a dress suit. Little woman liked it. Dot, Mr. Cleet, my husband's partner, such a clever man, man of the world, so amusing. Dot, when he dines there, and they are alone. Oh, Mr. Cleet, I wish George would do something to improve our prospects. Our position is really so mediocre. Dot, and Cleet smiles, but isn't surprised, because he had put all these notions himself into her empty head. Dot, what your husband wants is enterprise, a little audacity. You can encourage him best, Mrs. Dunbar. Dot, she was a silly, extravagant little fool. Had made George take a house in Norwood.
live up to a lot of people better off than themselves. I saw her once, silk dress, pretty boots, all feathers and scent, pink face. More like the promenade at the Alhambra than a decent home, it looked to me. But some women do get a devil of a hold on a man. Yes, some do, I assented. Then when the man is the husband. My missus, he addressed me unexpectedly, in a solemn, surprisingly hollow tone, could wind me round her little finger. I didn't find it out till she was gone. But she was a woman of sense, while that piece of goods ought to have been walking the streets, and that's all I can say. You must make her up out of your head. You will know the sort. Leave all that to me, I said. H'm, he grunted, doubtfully, then going back to his scornful tone. Month or so afterwards the sagamore arrives home. All very jolly at first. Hello, George boy. Hello, Harry, old man. But by and by Captain Harry thinks his clever brother is not looking very well. And George begins to look worse. He can't get rid of Cleet's notion. It is stuck in his head. There's nothing wrong quite well. Captain Harry still anxious. Business going all right, eh? Quite right. Lots of business. Good business. Of course Captain Harry believes that easily. Starts chaffing his brother in his jolly way about rolling in money. George's shirt sticks to his back with perspiration, and he feels quite angry with the captain. The fool, he says to himself. Rolling in money, indeed. And then he thinks suddenly. Why not? Because Cleet's notion has got hold of his mind. But next day he weakens and says to Cleet. Perhaps it would be best to sell. Couldn't you talk to my brother? And Cleet explains to him over again for the 20th time why selling wouldn't do, anyhow. No. The sagamore must be tomahawked, as he would call it, to spare George's feelings, maybe. But every time he says the word, George shudders. I've got a man at hand competent for the job who will do the trick for 500, and only too pleased at the chance, says Cleet. George shuts his eyes tight at that sort of talk, but at the same time he thinks, humbug, there can be no such man. And yet if there was such a man it would be safe enough perhaps. And Cleet always funny about it. He couldn't talk about anything without it seeming there was a great joke in it somewhere. Now, says he, I know you are a moral citizen, George. Morality is mostly funk, and I think you're the funkiest man I ever came across in my travels. Why, you are afraid to speak to your brother. Afraid to open your mouth to him with a fortune for us all in sight. George flares up at this. No, he ain't afraid. He will speak. Bangs fist on the desk. And Cleet pats him on the back. We'll be made men presently, he says. But the first time George attempts to speak to Captain Harry his heart slides down into his boots. Captain Harry only laughs at the notion of staying ashore. He wants no holiday, not he. But Jane thinks of remaining in England this trip. Go about a bit, and see some of her people. Jane was the captain's wife. Round-faced, pleasant lady. George gives up that time, but Cleet won't let him rest. So he tries again, and the captain frowns. He frowns because he's puzzled. He can't make it out. He has no notion of living away from his sagamore. I cried. Oh, I understand. No, you don't, he growled, his black, contemptuous stare turning on me crushingly. I beg your pardon, I murmured. H'm. Very well, then. Captain Harry looks very stern, and George crumples all up inside. He sees through me, he thinks. Of course it could not be, but George, by that time, was scared at his own shadow. He is shirking it with Cleet, who gives his partner to understand that his brother has half a mind to try a spell on shore, and so on. Cleet waits, gnawing his fingers, so anxious. Cleet really had found a man for the job. Believe it or not, he had found him inside the very boarding house he lodged in somewhere about Tottenham Court Road. He had noticed downstairs a fellow a boarder, and not a boarder, hanging about the dark part of the passage mostly, sort of man of the house, apostrophe a slinking chap. Black eyes. White face. The woman of the house a widow lady, she called herself very full of Mr. Stafford. Mr. Stafford this and Mr. Stafford that. Anyhow, Cleet one evening takes him out to have a drink. Cleet mostly passed away his evenings in saloon bars. No drunkard, though, Cleet, for company, liked to talk to all sorts there. Just habit, American fashion. So Cleet takes that chap out more than once. Not very good company, though. Little to say for himself. Sits quiet and drinks what's given to him, eyes always half closed, speaks sort of demure. I've had misfortunes, he says. The truth was they had kicked him out of a big steamship company for disgraceful conduct. Nothing to affect his certificate, you understand. And he had gone down quite easily. Liked it, I expect. Anything's better than work. Lived on the widow lady who kept that boarding house. That's almost incredible, I ventured to interrupt. Man with a master's certificate, do you mean? I do. I've known them bus cats, he growled, contemptuously. Yes. Swing on the tailboard by the strap and yell, tuppence all the way. Apostrophe apostrophe through drink. But this Stafford was of another kind. Hell's full of such Staffords. Cleet would make fun of him, and then there would be a nasty gleam in the fellow's half-shut eye. But Cleet was generally kind to him. Cleet was a fellow that would be kind to a mangy dog. Anyhow, he used to stand drinks to that object, and now and then gave him half a crown, because the widow lady kept Mr. Stafford short of pocket money. They had rows almost every day down in the basement. It was the fellow being a sailor that put into Cleet's mind the first notion of doing away with the sagamore. He studies him a bit, thinks there's enough devil in him yet to be tempted, and one evening he says to him, I suppose you wouldn't mind going to sea again, for a spell? The other never raises his eyes, says it's scarcely worth one's while for the miserable salary one gets. Well, but what do you say to captain's wages for a time, and a couple of hundred extra, if you are compelled to come home without the ship? Accidents will happen, says Cleet. Oh, sure to, says that Stafford, and goes on taking sips of his drink, as if he had no interest in the matter. Cleet presses him a bit, but the other observes, impudent and languid-like. You see, there's no future in a thing like that, is there? Oh. No, says Cleet. Certainly not. I don't mean this to have any future as far as you are concerned. It's a once-for-all transaction. Well, what do you estimate your future at? He asks. The fellow more listless than ever nearly asleep. I believe the skunk was really too lazy to care. Small cheating at cards, wheedling or bullying his living out of some woman or other, was more his style. Cleet swears at him and whispers something awful. All this in the saloon bar of the Horseshoe, Tottenham Court Road. Finally they agree, over the second sixpenny worth of scotch hot, on £500 as the price of tomahawking the sagamore. And Cleet waits to see what George can do. A week or two goes by. The other fellow loafs about the house, as if there had been nothing, and Cleet begins to doubt whether he really means ever to tackle that job. But one day he stops Cleet at the door, with his downcast eyes. What about that employment you wish to give me, he asks. You see, he had played some more than usual dirty trick on the woman and expected awful ructions presently, and to be fired out for sure. Cleet very pleased. George had been prevaricating to him such a lot that he really thought the thing was as well as settled. And he says, yes, it's time I introduced you to my friend. Just get your hat and we will go now. The two come into the office, and George at his desk sits up in a Gutenberg edition.
End of chapter.